And it's a myth that Israel is a nice, friendly state. Netanyahu has seized the moment, and he's going for broke.
It seems like Gaza is going to be annihilated. I'm not sure how that stops.
I think there have been seven different occasions on which Israel or its negotiators have penciled an agreement only for Netanyahu to tear it up.
Another interesting person has been Piers Morgan.
He's coming from a different place, from Tucker Carlson, completely different place. He is coming from the position of liberal Zionism. The person who overruled Starmer was no other than Theresa May, i.e. a conservative Home Secretary who had a better sense of humanity than Starmer did. That's the Starmer we're talking about.
Through Palestine Action and through all the protests, where do you think that eventually takes British politics?
Most will stay there. Why will they stay? Because they realize what this conflict's all about. This conflict is all about land.
Okay, we're ready. You good, Yasin? Do I need to clap or something?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I loved it. I love the old-fashioned clap. I just love it. It's just all this new digital stuff. We still got to clap.
No, we've got to clap. We've got to clap. It's very important. Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm your host, Ishfar Karim, and I'm joined today by someone who's no stranger to anyone who sees Middle East. David Hurst,
our
editor-in-chief. Welcome, David. David, if you don't know him yet, he's been the co-founder of Middle East Eye, which is almost 11 years, is our chief editor. He's a veteran journalist. He's worked for more than 30 years, I think, for The Guardian. Worked out of Berlin, Moscow, parts of the Middle East. So, David, really good to have you on our show.
Thank you.
David, just first up, we're going to have quite a long conversation today. It's going to be about UK government's complicity in the genocide. It's going to be about the killing of journalists. And it's also going to be about just how the world can kind of rein in Israel. That seems to be on a rampant warpath, and the role of both the power elites and the media elites in kind of emboldening Israel, and how the narrative around that's changing. Last week, while Dahdu was in our office, and you gave him an award, the first award Middle East has given out in 11 years for excellence in journalism, you mentioned in your speech while welcoming him, you mentioned that we've seen his, you know, he's recorded horrid images out of Gaza and reported on that, and hence we're giving this to him. But the quote was, "This is the worst evil the century has faced at the hands of Israel." Tell us why this is the worst evil that the, you know, that the century has seen.
Well, there are several elements to that assessment. One is the complete lack of brakes. There are no handbrakes on Israel. And if you go back to all the incursions, the many incursions that they've done in the past, in Gaza or in southern Lebanon, it was finite. And Netanyahu was quite cautious. He stopped short of going into Gaza City several times. They did the same thing, but this is on a much, much bigger scale. And no one stopped him. They kept on supplying him with bombs to actually do it. And for once, he is on a mission to wipe not just Hamas out or the militant factions, but Palestinians out. And he's currently demolishing the whole of Gaza City. This is against the consistent advice of his military leaders, who say all you're going to do is kill our own hostages, which is what's happening. There have been killed since that's happened. It's and every single time someone gives him the wrong advice, he changes them. It was against the advice of Shin Bet. It was against the advice of the so-called elites that always restrained Netanyahu. Netanyahu wanted to bomb Iran several times in his very long history as prime minister. And notably in 2010, he was stopped by his own security establishment. Now there are no brakes on him, either internally or indeed externally. The biggest disappointment was Joe Biden's administration. But the encouragement now is given by Donald Trump. Even though we can discuss this now, there are very interesting splits within the Republican Party. Cracks are emerging, but not quickly enough to actually stop the carnage. And you have got an Israeli administration, which really is being led by its most extreme element. By extreme, these are the people who would have been considered terrorists, part of the Jewish underground, 2 decades ago. They were the people responsible for the murder of an Israeli prime minister. And they're now in control. Not only in their control, they're in control of the West Bank. And I think Netanyahu has seized the moment, and he's going for broke. And broke, in an Israeli sense, isn't just getting rid of all armed resistance, which again is, I think most people would say, impossible. It is getting rid of a huge swathe of Palestinians, and to make any possibility of a Palestinian state impossible to achieve, which I think has already happened. So Israel going for broke is actually Israel on a religious mission to reclaim what they consider to be biblical Israel in the mess of the Middle East, with an America that is not physically but morally and mentally in retreat, and has completely run out of ideas after the war on terror, where everything, all liberal intervention, failed. I mean, if you think about it, the West hasn't won a war since Kosovo, and that's some time ago. So this is why I say that the carnage, the genocide in Gaza, is the worst evil of this century.
I mean, I would think that, I mean, I don't like the game of trying to calculate what's the worst evil, but I think critics, I mean, people listening to it may say, what about Sudan? What about what happened in Syria? What's happened in Iraq? But I think there's an element to this with, it's been 23 months of, you know, targeting tents, targeting buildings. I mean, it's kind of a horror story, what GHF has done in terms of, you know, starving people first, and then people come through these death traps and they get shot at.
Yeah, but the reason I say this, Ashfaq, is it's been planned.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's the calculated aspect of all of this.
I think evil isn't just a question of happenstance. It isn't just a question, we're making hay because the sun is shining for us. It was absolutely planned. Everything that
no, that's the point.
Planned.
You can see the choreograph again.
And that's part of actually the legal case of genocide, yes. Because it's been done with malice aforethought.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, the other genocides of the recent past, Rwanda, Srebrenica, horrible atrocities, sometimes even bigger on the scale of death, but sort of just losing it in terms of a society, whereas the calculation on this is really evil and really, and I think that's a lot of what we want to get through today. Another aspect throughout this whole thing is, and it's almost a new phenomenon, but it really isn't, but I think because of the media, it's a new phenomenon, is the gaslighting and denialism. At the same time, the celebration. Inside of Israel, there's celebration of the atrocities, often from members of the government, from settlers, from regular people on the street. At the same time, those people deny it to the international media. Often they don't. Sometimes they admit it. And then there's the gaslighting that we are actually the victims. It's Hamas's fault. They are not releasing the hostages. Just your comments on that.
That's a very old tactic. And it's part of, and they're playing on Jewish history as the perennial victims. And that is the motivation behind a Jewish state. I mean, there are quite a few motivations, but for diaspora Jews, they say Israel is the only place where Jews have agency. Of course, that is absolutely wrong. And it isn't the lesson of the Holocaust that there has to be a Jewish state. In fact, most of the Holocaust survivors, including my parents and most of their family, were non-Zionists. Half of them were, but the other half went. And so it was, even in the 30s and at the end of the Second World War, to set up shop in Israel was not a slam dunk. You can say there were boatloads of Jews who had nowhere else to go to. And there's notorious examples of America not accepting Jews. Yes, that did happen. But ultimately, the link between Israel and what it does and the Holocaust is a much more nuanced one than history has been rewritten to have us believe. And I think that, but it's a large part of the sort of myth that Jews are victims and that Israel is always under attack. In fact, it's attacked first. And so while the immediate knee-jerk response to October the 7th was said, yes, here's another heinous attack, and it was a heinous attack, it was terrorism. No one's going to deny that. What happened every day before October the 7th, and certainly what's happened every day afterwards, has been of the same order. And I think really the reaction in Israel to the Hamas attack wasn't they've terrorized us, but how dare these Palestinians do to us what we do to them on a daily basis.
Specifically, I want to just hone in a bit on the lack of a ceasefire. And obviously, you've been covering this for the whole 23 months. You're aware of the intricacies. But again, this is, again, for our audiences, there's sort of like this myth that, oh, it's you know, whenever Israel are trying to make peace, Hamas aren't giving out the hostages. Just debunk that for us. Just tell us what exactly you understand from the negotiations and who's been stalling the process
there. I think I'm losing track of this quite quickly, but I think there have been seven different occasions on which Israel or its negotiators have penciled an agreement only for Netanyahu to tear it up. There have been several occasions where Hamas have actually signed a document in the presence of a director of the CIA of both administrations for Netanyahu then to tear it up. I think the consensus in Israel, and this is not an original thought, is he's done it for his own political calculations, not because of Gaza. I think from an Israeli point of view, the IDF are right in saying there is no military objective other than killing Palestinians in continuing. This is what a former defense minister said when he resigned. It is what anyone studying the situation. If you actually want to release the hostages, you have to do a deal with Hamas. Otherwise, there will be no hostages left alive, and that will soon be the case. So he has constantly shifted his negotiating team. Is the man now in charge of it is the person who devised his strategy right from the start, Ron Dermer. And he was the one who was tasked with starting the strategy of starvation as a weapon of mass destruction. And he's been Netanyahu's right-hand man throughout. He's now the head of the negotiating team because the others were deemed to be too soft. They came to an agreement, and that is not what Israel wanted. There is an offer on the table right now, which is basically Steve Witkoff's plan. And again, Israel is simply just ignoring that. The only thing that would stop Netanyahu from ignoring what an American envoy of whatever description, but currently it's Trump's right-hand man, Witkoff, says is Trump himself. So we really have to ask ourselves, what is Trump? What is stopping Trump calling time from this operation?
I mean, both Mustafa Barghouti and Gershon Baskin, who's sort of a negotiator with Hamas, he's been a negotiator with them for many years. They've said that as early as last year, August, Hamas put it in writing to both of them. Gershon also testifies to this, that Hamas would have agreed that they wouldn't be in charge of Gaza when this ends.
Yeah.
All they're asking for is that the humanitarian aid comes in, Israel withdraws from the strip, and obviously the prisoners, what Israel holds as hostages and as captives, are released. And Israel has just denied it. They've just completely consistently done this. And I think this is something that the saddest part to this, and I think we'll get to this, is that this is not, it's known and it's happened, but it's just not reported by the media. And it's consistently said in statements that, you know, it's Hamas holding on to the hostages. And it's part of this weird thing we've spoken about where it's like gaslighting and victim blaming and so much, you know, confusion, obfuscation is created. So people don't really know why the war is continuing while Netanyahu creates his plan. Just another thing that's been happening are these weird plans. And you've written about this recently, to turn Gaza into some sort of riviera. And obviously, the plans itself may still be contested on. It's just a PowerPoint presentation at this point. But there's this idea that while people are being displaced and ethnically cleansed and starved, there's already sort of development plans for what happens to the Strip. Very, you know, grandiose plans. Just what's your comments on this, on that?
I think there's a real coldness about these plans. I mean, for one, just one tiny detail, and that is, how long do they think it's going to take to get the bodies out from the rubble in the buildings? They're still, decades on digging up bodies from Srebrenica. Would they bother to recover all the bodies that are under rubble? Or would they do the sort of Russian Tsarist thing of literally concreting over dead bodies? They haven't brought any thought to that. All they think of is, oh yeah, we must get rid of these tunnels because of the foundations of the skyscrapers, you know. It makes it all a bit shaky. I mean, they think of it purely in terms of money and real estate. And the most horrible aspect of the latest plan, everyone denies authorship. They initial, but we think there were two Israelis who were responsible for at least for the latest version of this plan. The idea of a sort of Trump Riviera, where you name roundabouts and freeways off various people who are going to pay for it, particularly the Gulf leaders, is it lacks all humanity. This is a paradise of buildings and roundabouts without any people in it, and certainly without any Palestinian people in it. And in fact, the latest version is a scheme to pay Palestinians to get out and stay away and go on a one-way ticket. And I was talking about this to Wael Dadouch when he came over in the office last week. And I asked this question quite seriously. So how many people will take the money and run? And the answer is very, very thought out. This is some will, obviously. There'll always be people who will go and take the money. Most will stay there. Why will they stay? Because they realize what this conflict's all about. This conflict is all about land. And I believe that. And I believe that through this immense suffering, there is true heroism. Journalists who are heroes, but also the ordinary people of Gaza who are heroes for standing their ground and saying, no, we won't go.
You mentioned the heroism of journalists. Two of our colleagues on the 25th of August, just a few days ago, were killed by Israel, Ahmed Abu Aziz and Mohammed Salama. It prompted you to write an open letter to Keir Starmer on his behavior throughout Israel's genocide. You also put forth in there 5 points that you'd like him to sort of answer. Before we actually get to those points, just recall for us what you can remember. I don't expect you to remember all of it in the letters in front of you now, but just what were the key points you kind of wrote to him? Over his own sort of complicity and doggedness and hypocrisy on the matter?
Well, first of all, the first point is that any prime minister of Britain has a historic responsibility. And that comes from the Balfour Declaration. It comes from 1917. It comes from the time when Britain and France were feasting over the remains of the Ottoman Empire and dividing up between them in that part of the world. The so-called Sykes-Picot Agreement. It is that Balfour said that any agreement, he talked about Jewish homeland, he didn't talk about a Jewish state. And he said any agreement that came to the resettlement of Jews in Palestine, because at that time they were about 5% of the population, had to address the human rights of the Palestinians who were there. And that's never been, and Lammy himself, David Lammy, the former foreign secretary, now deputy prime minister, reminded everyone at a UN conference of precisely that pledge. In reality, what has happened, and this is the sort of second point, is that Starmer chose a political direction after Jeremy Corbyn. That was very calculated. He had chosen a direction because he when he was a minister of Corbyn's shadow cabinet, or minister, he was a, he was promoted in to an important portfolio, not ministry, by Corbyn. He kept his thoughts to himself. He said he was neither a Zionist nor a non-Zionist. He's very cautious about what he said. It was only when he became leader that his fangs started showing. And I think it was a very calculated move to go to the right, or to go to the center, political center, to go towards Blairism. And one key ingredient of Blairism is not to have a cigarette paper of distance between you and Washington. He'd already, there had already been one episode before when he was DPP, which really formed him as he turned him from a human rights lawyer into a man of law and order, a purely who believed in harsh punishment. There was a case of a disturbed young man who had hacked into the Pentagon computers. America, the Attorney General Eric Holder at the time, under Obama, wanted his extradition. And had he been handed over, he would have faced a lifetime in prison. And he wasn't a security threat. He did it because he wanted to prove himself he could. I think he was autistic. Starmer really did want to hand him over. There was a compromise on offer that he could be prosecuted under British law, which is eventually what happened. The person who overruled Starmer was no other than Theresa May, i.e. a conservative Home Secretary who was more, his name was Gary McKinnon, who had a better sense of humanity than Starmer did. That's the Starmer we're talking about. But he revealed himself slowly, and I think the left were enormously naive in thinking that he could be a compromise between right and left in the party. And he defined himself in as someone who'd root out anti-Semitism in the party. He defined himself in terms of what Corbyn was not. And Corbyn was a very, very strong voice on Palestine, who had been mugged by a whole number of elements, but particularly the Israeli government, in anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, as if it was a proven fact. In fact, there was more anti-Semitism under Ed Miliband as leader of the party than initially there was under Corbyn. And Starmer took all these decisions so that he could become, in his eyes, a credible leader and someone who's absolutely dead close to whatever administration there was going to be in America. And so after the Hamas attack, he not only throttled any attempt at calls at ceasefire within his own party and made it an offence to appear at any of the demonstrations. But he made it impossible for the SNP also, through a procedural device, to get a motion which actually expressed what most people wanted. So he actually, as prime minister this time, not as opposition leader, went out of his way to keep Israel, that Israeli offensive in the early months, in business. Before that, he did an infamous interview with LBC. This is, I think, before his election, in which he appeared to say, although he afterwards said I was answering a different question, that Israel had the right to withdraw electricity and water from Gaza. So he was literally pushing and pressing all the buttons that Israel wanted from a British prime minister. And he did this cynically. The old Starmer, as a human rights lawyer, appeared at a BDS demonstration. This is not him thinking with his heart. This is him thinking politically. And I think now that's got him in a lot of trouble, because I think the tide has turned. I think not only Israel has lost a generation of supporters, you can see it every day in London. There was a very big demonstration in which people, you know, I think nearly 1,000 people have been arrested.
Yes. I mean, it's
a there's a very, very strong movement. So it's not just Israel that's lost a generation of supporters. Yeah, Starmer has as well, and the Labour Party.
Are we going to speak about a lot about that a bit more? Even in the US, latest poll, so that 60% of US citizens polled wanted the US to stop all military aid to Israel. So that's very substantial. And we'll get to all of that later on. Also, just speak a bit more about sort of British politics and what the alternatives for Starmer is like. But before that, just the five specific things that you asked for, they're very specific. They're very specific for journalists. And the idea is to get information so that we can then do our job better and investigate the UK's possible participation, if not just their complicity in the genocide. I don't want to repeat those questions, those 5 points, but just maybe speak to them a bit more. But the real question I want to ask you is, what do you think the public needs to be asking of Starmer and the British government to sort of bring this to an end, bring what's happening in Gaza to an end?
When are you going to stop arming Israel? When are you going to stop providing the parts that the F-35s need? When are you going to stop the surveillance flights from Akrotiri? What have you learned in the surveillance flights? Does that information go to Israel or does it go to us? What are you doing over, flying over an area where there are repeated hits on civilians and targets that supposedly Hamas that don't ever turn out to be Hamas? There are two legal processes going on, which are very, very important. Both of them have been stalled, one for war crimes against Netanyahu personally, but also the Hamas leadership, all of them dead now, at the International Criminal Court, and another one, a genocide, at the International Court of Justice, one at a court in Geneva, the other court at the Court of The Hague. You have lifted your objections to the International Criminal Court. But lifting objections is not good enough. What are you actively doing to provide evidence? And will you, for instance, Britain has international obligations because it's a member of the Statute of Rome. Are you going to uphold those obligations if visiting members of the Israeli government turn up in Britain? Are you going to arrest them? Because there's a prima facie case against them. The evidence is that each time anyone turns up here, it's either deemed a private visit or it has Foreign Office immunity. But that's not upholding international law. If you are if we really are a country that believes in international justice, why aren't you upholding it with Israel? Is Israel always the exception? These are very, very serious questions. And I think it's the questions that everyone really wants to ask them. We know repeatedly that the government and successive governments will refuse to go down this path. And it's public opinion against, voting doesn't matter, actually. It doesn't matter which government we've got in. They all do the same thing, and particularly on this issue. But there will come a time when that changes. And we've simply got to press in every single conceivable way for the application of British foreign policy. The application of British foreign policy is for a two-state solution. The application of British foreign policy is that we arrest people who are on the run, who have international arrest warrants against them. We don't cooperate with them. We don't do deals under the table. So this is about getting a British government to apply its own rules and its own laws in its relationship with a rogue state.
To be honest with you, when I hear that, it sounds like it should be so normal because it's within the bounds of what is espoused as policy. It somehow also seems really unrealistic, but it also seems like it won't be enough. South Africa, sanctions was applied fully. Economic sanctions was applied on South Africa before, the apartheid government decided to start negotiating with Nelson Mandela. Do you think a lot of what you said is repeated in your five questions, and it's very important for us as journalists to investigate so we can get the information out there into the UK complicity. But don't you think the public actually needs to be asking for a lot more so that we can really, it seems like Gaza is going to be annihilated. I'm not sure how that stops. I'm not sure how any incentives can be put on Israel or Netanyahu to kind of curtail what they're doing, or even allow a rebuild.
I think the only way Gaza stops if Trump calls time, and what's in Trump's brain is very difficult to predict, because he does it on whim, he does it on thought, he does it on image. He works on reality TV.
Yep.
So when he calls time, might be tomorrow, it might be next year, but that will be the only break on Gaza.
I think it's actually even beyond that. I think it may stop what Israel's doing, but it won't force or create, definitely won't force a rebuild.
No.
Because what's that life going to be like for the Palestinians to remain? Sure. It's a GHF life for the next, unless there's major interventions, many administrations, Israeli administrations. And so what we really want to get to now is the Starmer's kind of Manchurian candidate way of governing. It has definitely, lost. People are leaving Labour. Corbyn and Zara Sultana are starting your party. The Green Party has been very outspoken on Gaza. Do you see these parties really standing a formidable chance in the upcoming elections? Polls put Reform as the will probably be much worse on Gaza than the Labour Party even, and the Conservatives. How do you see that coming? How do you see the spark that Gaza has created and the discomfort we see through Palestine Action and through all the protests? Where do you think that eventually takes British politics?
I think, just to sort of zoom out a little bit, there are several crises taking place. There are three levels of crisis, in fact. There are all the initiatives on Palestine that haven't worked in the past, but we've never learned the lessons from, including Oslo. And that has an effect on current behavior. There's a chaos generated by today. And the third aspect of chaos is what's happening in our own societies. And what's happening is that liberal democracy is melting down, and it's polarizing. So the really big threat to Starmer isn't Corbyn or the left. It is Reform. And exactly the same thing has happened in France. And Starmer appears to be applying exactly the same thing that Macron has, i.e. the more threat there is, the further right he goes, and the more he sort of tries to smother them by adopting their policies. So he reacts. Now, he's being seen to react.
It's what happened in Israel also.
And it's also what happened in Israel, yeah. So he reacts to, or he's been seen to react to, Farage's latest idea to stop the business over the hotels is basically internment camps in MOD property. So Starmer, so Farage suggests something. The next minute, it's sort of government policy. So what I see, if I'm right, and what we're seeing is a fundamental realignment of British politics, French politics. We're seeing a deep polarization between the left and the extreme right. And the center ground is going to get much, much weaker. I think, again, this is the fundamental mistake of Starmer in reinventing Blairism when there was no demand for it. No one, either in the Labour Party or outside it, or even in the Parliamentary Party, thought of bringing Blair back as a inspirational figure. we'd all got so sick of him evading his responsibility for the Iraq war. You know, we were very content for him to go elsewhere and to have lectures abroad, but we basically didn't want him in Britain. Starmer's brought him all the way back again, and his advisors, Mandelson, who's now, what is Mandelson being back in as a U.S. ambassador all about? What is Blair being back? What is Tim Allen being back? These are guys who have a lot to answer for. I mean, a lot to answer for on Iraq, on Ukraine. Tim Allen, I seem to remember, was the man behind the organization that was rehabilitating Putin after Chechnya, where I was a correspondent. And I could see everything that Putin was doing, you know, before it happened in Ukraine. It's exactly the same thing happened when Putin was devastating Chechnya. And these guys are back. They're the ones who are, and they've got no mandate. And there was no call for them to go back. Starmer could have created an alliance with the left and used it, not necessarily with Corbyn himself. And that's what Biden did. Biden did with Bernie Sanders, but that was not the route he took. So I think he's politically in a lot of trouble, but Farage doesn't actually have to do that much. All he has to do is wait for Starmer to disintegrate. And he's a cheapy chappy. He's basically conservative, who loves all the trappings of state. I mean, him playing the disruptor is a joke. He is an old-fashioned, Farage is an old-fashioned conservative, but he is politically 10 times more adept at seizing the moment than Starmer is. Starmer is Mr. Wooden Tops. He's a Robocop. He's got absolute, and that was the other problem of embracing Blairism. You have Blair without the charm, without the ability, without Blair's ability to sell his message, and that was his number one gift. His smile was his number one gift as a political, his relaxed nature and the cleverness of what he was doing against at the time of Clause 4 and the Labour Party. And he got away with it. And his undoing was the Iraq war. It wasn't domestic policy. Starmer's undoing will be the economy, because he won't be able to swing this round if he depends on growth coming from elsewhere and you've got growth being stifled by the movement of money, being stifled by tariffs, being stifled by the huge debt we're still suffering from that we paid over COVID. That is a huge debt to pay out. And the wiggle room for Starmer with his own rules is very slim. And he had a reshuffle, and it lasted, and the feel-good factor lasted as long as the announcements were made. And then suddenly Andy Burnham tucked in and said, you haven't elected anyone from the North, and you need us. And so dead right he is. Labour, London Labour, does need the North. But Starmer has got this now an authoritarian style. He chucked out the left with Stalinist zeal. It wasn't the politics of what he was doing, it was how he was doing that was so revealing. It was defaming people, honest people, as racists and anti-Semites, people who had not had an anti-Semitic thought in their lives. It was the way he did it, not necessarily the fact that he and the left were two different creatures. That one can accept within a Labour Party, but the means with which he used to put his own people in is now coming back to bite him, because he hasn't got that many friends in the Labour Party, particularly in the parliamentary Labour Party. So I think Farage is gaining simply by sitting back,
by being himself,
and waiting for Starmer to make his next mistake. And I think that's the process at work. As far as the left is concerned, they don't have a name. They don't really have a party. What they have is this enormous constituency wanting them to make the next announcement. And so I think what we've got now isn't a question of one election. It's a question of a process over a number of elections. And Farage will do what Marine Le Pen did in France. She will keep on going until he's in power. And he'll build up a party. I mean, the last time Reform had problems with wacky candidates who were easy to destroy because they had said something or done something that was impossible. So it'll take a while to get the right candidates and to choose it. It'll get a while to get a national organization. Reform has to not just have flags outside hotels, but it has to have basically a presence in every street to win power. And Farage will build that bit by bit. So it won't be necessarily a campaign of one election. It'll be a campaign of quite a few elections. And I'm just waiting for the time that Starmer crumbles. Now, there was a Republican vote in France, which was anything but Marine Le Pen, right? It was a vote for the Republic, for the Constitution, that somehow the far right was a threat to the Constitution, such as it was of France, the Republic itself. And it was deemed, just as monarchists were deemed, as a danger to the state. Whether those politics, and that will work out in a British context, where you have a royal family, where you have a head of state, and where Farage is not deemed a threat to, there's no republic, right, to political order. He's just deemed a threat to liberal democracy. Whether that will still, and people will vote anything but Farage, whether that will emerge as a trend in the next election, I really don't know. I simply don't know enough to be able to say that. But if Starmer can't turn the economy around pretty quickly and can't give ordinary people a sense that life is harder than it was, they've got the same wages as they had in 2016, but prices have rocketed through the roof. If people have to keep on doing two jobs just to hold down the rent, I think Labour's in a lot of trouble.
Do you think, it sounds like you don't think at the moment the left is ready to kind of fill into that vacuum or take advantage of this huge constituency?
Yeah, I'm not sure how prepared they are, and I'm not sure how united they are, and I'm not sure how far they've worked it out. But I may be happily be proved wrong, because that would be a counterbalance. And I don't know how many Labour MPs would defect to whatever party that Corbyn started. I mean, he's already failed once, so that isn't a terribly good sign. And I think Corbyn failed not because he wasn't a decent man. He's a decent man. Or because he had the wrong ideas. I think he failed because he wasn't tough enough and didn't push back enough. But he became a Christmas tree.
Yeah, it was too nice.
You know, well, he became a Christmas tree, on which you could literally hang any claim you want, and he wore it. He didn't defend himself. He does now. He has sharp teeth with lawyers with sharp teeth, but he didn't then. And I think that was a huge mistake, particularly over anti-Semitism.
Okay. A big part of this discussion, why we're having it, is because, we've seen arguably the longest protest movement and against Israel in UK in a long while. And the protests in the UK have been very big, as you mentioned, almost 1,000 people arrested. And we're seeing public sentiment shift throughout, especially in the US. I mentioned earlier on that 60% of US citizens now, according to the latest polls, are against arming Israel, which is very significant, 75%. I'm bringing up my computer now because I want to play some clips. We want to kind of look at that change by looking at two very popular media personalities, and there's many we can discuss, but specifically Tucker Carlson and Piers Morgan. You also mentioned them both in a column recently. Now, yes, it's interesting. Pierce is definitely, I mean, I wouldn't, he's almost on the right, but in the middle. Tucker Carlson, you know, traditionally has been very far right in the US. But what's interesting in the US, and we'll get to Pierce later on, we'll first speak to Tucker Carlson, is there's a few podcasters on the right. No less than Bannon, who is not at all like how Tucker Carlson is in terms of his articulation of the problems with Israel and the U.S. arming Israel. But even he is dead against the U.S. continuing its support against Israel. We've also seen Candace Owens. There's two interviews that we're just going to play very brief clips of and then comment on this. This is his interview with Ted Cruz. We'll just play it for a while.
Why is Israel...
I'm obsessed with Israel.
Okay, but I think a lot of people are. And like the question, Israel spies on us. Well, so does every other country. Why are you mad at Israel?
I guess, I'm hardly the one who's... I've never taken money from the Israel lobby. Have you?
Taken money from the Israel...
From AIPAC.
So AIPAC raises a lot of money for me, but it's actually a misnomer because the people who raise money are individuals. Right. So it's not the PAC itself, but they're individual members who believe in the American-Israeli friendship and relationship.
Is AIPAC a foreign lobby?
No, it's an American lobby. It's the AIPAC stands for the America-Israeli Political Action Committee.
What does it lobby for?
So, to be honest, not a whole lot effectively. Listen, I came into Congress 13 years ago with the stated intention of being the leading defender of Israel in the United States Senate.
Great.
And I've worked every day to do that. AIPAC, a lot of times...
Okay, we don't have time to see the whole interview, but I mean, this is one of many interviews that Tucker Carlson has had recently. In the specific interview, he also pushes Ted Cruz on the West Bank, on the ideas of Judea Samaria, on his evangelical Christian roots and why he prioritizes those ideas instead of U.S. interests and policy. I'm sure you've seen it. What do you make of that split in the U.S.? What elements of the right or even the far right becoming extremely skeptical of the U.S.'s consistent support, especially from a military point of view of Israel? And how do you see it playing out?
It's unexpected. It's extremely significant. What you're seeing is a very skillful interviewer taking Ted Cruz apart in a really informed way. Now, interestingly, if you contrast what Tucker Carlson said after the Hamas attack and what he's saying now, the move has been the movement has been extraordinary, and I think what that is saying is that they are what's coming out is a huge skepticism about the claims that Israel has made as to why it is doing what it's doing. The expression of, you could call it American isolationism, the expression of, why are we doing this? Where is the American interest in supporting Israel doing this? The American interest is in pushing Israel to make peace with its neighbors. The American interest is the Abraham Accords. The American interest is in deconfliction, not reconfliction. And I think they're expressing all of that very powerfully. And it is at least one half of Trump's base that it is, why are we doing these foreign wars? Nothing seems to be working. You can call it isolationism or you can call it realism, that everything, as I said, since Kosovo has basically gone wrong and Gaza's going wrong from America's point of view, because Hamas should have been crushed a long time ago. Now, had Hamas been crushed a long time ago and had they waved a white flag, had they done what Yasser Arafat did in Beirut in 1982 and just simply said, fine, we're being bombarded, we'll leave for Tunisia. And they raised the white flag. And then you had the picture of the Hamas leadership actually getting on a boat or getting on a plane and saying goodbye. Israel would have stopped this. Yeah, that's what they wanted. They wanted total victory.
Do you think they would have stopped?
I think so. I think they would have stopped. They would have. They would have halted. They would have halted, right? But they didn't get that. It's because Hamas hasn't surrendered that this is going. Now, this is a very, very, I didn't expect this to happen, but it is happening. It's not just the progressive left in America that has totally turned against Israel. It's also one half of the Republican Party, and it's a very important part of it, because that represents the party, or the part of the party that said, you know, after all these wars, I want to stop wars. Now, Trump isn't stopping the wars, and is carrying on, basically being led by the nose, right? So we talked about this before. How credible is Steve Witkoff, his envoy, as a Middle East envoy, or indeed as an envoy, if he's ignored by Israel or he's ignored by Putin? You know, how effective is this? Absolutely. This has an effect on foreign policy. Now, I don't think Tucker Carlson has any love for armed resistance, or would even call it like that. I certainly don't think he's got any love for the Palestinians either. But he is a pragmatist and a realist who's saying this isn't working. And our ticket, our platform, was in withdrawing from wars that don't work. It was the other side. It was the Democrats who, and Tucker Carlson's been extremely vocal, and rightly so. I agree with him, actually, on the myth of liberal interventionism that's caused one war after another in the Middle East, all due to the assumption that you can destroy a country completely and then remake it in your image. That failed in Afghanistan, it failed in Iraq, it failed in Libya, it failed in Syria, it's failed wherever it's been applied. Now, some of it was done under you know, people who would call themselves progressive on the political spectrum. That's what Tucker Carlson was aiming at. And now he's turned his guns on his own party because they're falling into the same trap as Biden. They're letting Israel get away with it.
I mean, we're not going to listen to this for too long because we're running out of time, but another very interesting was this one he had with who was actually a Christian nun, who Mother Agapia, who lives in Palestine. She's American. We'll just play this a little bit. And I mean, honestly, when I saw this, I felt in many ways it may be the most consequential interview that's been around in the English world since October 7th because of its potential to kind of enlighten.
Have you, you know, a lot of Christians in the Holy Land. Mm. How many support the government of Israel, do you know?
The Palestinians within Israel?
Yeah. Christians support the government of Israel.
I don't know that they would be, any that really would.
Any.
especially now.
Any.
I mean, they're literally throwing out Palestinian representatives.
So in the U.S., there's a sense that Christians support this program.
Of course not. And to the credit, you know, when I first moved there in 98, there was hope for peace. And there was a much stronger...
Okay, we're not going to listen to more of that. But I mean, it's interesting because this is something we hear about all the time and we cover. But Tucker is now getting this very credible message to a very interesting part of the American society. And I think it bodes well for a future situation.
It's not just about Muslims.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, also it's speaking to the Christians who, yeah, may, you know, for their own reasons, many of them are probably becoming Christian Zionists, who maybe because of Israel's atrocities are becoming, I mean, just to kind of back your claim that Tucker doesn't probably care much about Palestinians, is recently what he said about Greta Thunberg, who's currently aboard a flotilla. So we'll just play this before we move on.
Greta Thunberg. You weren't even that mean. You're like, she's clearly mentally ill, something like that.
I said the left is exploiting this mentally ill Swedish child.
It's so obviously true. So if you said that now, the only
reason... Right, so I mean, just, you're absolutely right. This is clearly, I mean, and this was 2 weeks ago. So this is not something from an archive. So you're absolutely right about this.
Tucker Carlson hasn't become a comrade, right?
no, absolutely. I mean,
but the phenomenon is really interesting because the phenomenon speaks to what, you know, is this good for America? And the answer is no, it's not.
Okay, so I mean, Piers Morgan's a bit more interesting. Before I just have two clips.
But can
to
I,
play over
can
him.
I,
yes,
can
absolutely.
I just make, with, yeah, yeah, can I just do. Make one point? I think it's tremendously important what's going on in America, possibly more important than any public shift anywhere else in the world, for two reasons. The the last 2 years in Gaza has huge resonances with what happened in the Vietnam War. It was very, very clear to the CIA 7 years before the end of the Vietnam War that they couldn't win. But many of the same things were applied. They wanted to de-radicalize, de-Viet Congize the villages. They wanted to create model villages. They wanted to separate out the guerrilla fighters, and they couldn't do any of that. And they lost, and they lost a lot. It took 7 years for them to get out, and another president, two presidents. That was Kennedy, LBJ, and Nixon, finally. And the two things that defeated American firepower, which was enormous, was the resilience of the Vietnamese people themselves, the peasants, and American public opinion. And the two things that are going to defeat all of these plans that we've been talking about are Palestinian resistance in all its forms, particularly nonviolent resistance, saying, no, I'm not going to leave.
Existing.
No, I'm not
existing.
Going to. Sumud. And American public opinion. And what we're seeing now is a disintegration of that automatic claim that Israel is shares our values, it should be an American state. All of that, all of the stuff that we've lived with is melting down. As a result of this, and they're questioning the instinctive Zionism of the progressive left, and they're questioning now the instinctive Zionism of the Republican Party. So what we're seeing with Tucker Carlson, you know, we may laugh about it and say, oh, ha ha ha, you know, look at him, is tremendously important.
Yeah, it is. Just one thing, just to retort on the 7 years to see, you know, the Vietnam War come to an end. The Israelis, I think, know that, and so the horrific nature is that they are continuously escalating and speeding up the operation in Gaza, and so we're seeing with Gaza City. There's these things you've probably seen them. Now they have robotic armored cars that drive around and have 7 tons of explosives and go off. It's been reported by the EU monitoring rights group on this, that about 10 to 11 of these guards go off every night recently. And they take out about 30 or 40 housing units with each explosion. So there's this Sumud, and there's this awful reality that Israel is creating facts on the ground, as they've done before Oslo, as they've done, honestly, since 67. And it really puts the Palestinian situation in a very sad point, and we'll discuss that when we get to the end of it.
Sad is an understatement. It's existential.
No, it's
it really is existential.
It really is existential. I think this is really existential. That term's used a lot, but this literally is existential. And it's very sad because, again, I think we need new language, because it's happening so live and with so much people seeing it and so much people knowing they're powerless while it's still occurring, and so many people who have power just involved in some game of denialism and trickery. And it's just, it's an entirely new concept. I mean, I think it's always been there, like you mentioned, but I think given the kind of connectivity we live into today's
world, this is what I mean when
strange.
I use the word evil.
Yeah, I wasn't...
Exactly,
it's exactly evil. Another interesting person has been Piers Morgan. Now, just before I actually go into his clips, I think to his credit, he's platformed many Palestinian voices, he's platformed many people who are very, you know, articulate in their criticisms of Israel. Bassem Youssef, he's platformed doctors who've gotten back, whistleblowers like Anthony Aguilar, who, you know, was part of the GHF sort of effort before he decided to leave his position out of disgust. And that's been very, very important. Again, after October 7th, he, you know, repeated a lot of the Israeli lies about beheaded babies, about people in ovens, all sorts of things. We're not going to play a lot of his clips, but just, I think there's one clip which is 3 months old, which is relatively new. And it's when he started being a lot more, by his own admission, a lot more forceful against Israeli guests. So we're gonna see some of that pushback first, right? And then play one other clip. So this is his pushback against Israeli guests.
That's none of your business whether the journalists view their safety as being at risk.
I'm sorry, you haven't heard the reasons yet. The first, of course, is the safety of the journalists, and I appreciate you don't accept that. The second...
I think it's a load of nonsense.
The second is the safety...
The idea you're doing is out of some quaint concern for the safety of journalists is bullshit.
That was reason number one. Reason number two is the ability...
These better get better.
...is the ability of IDF soldiers to be able to conduct this war against Hamas without...
Without the journalists getting in the way?
No, without...
They've killed more journalists in Palestinian journalists.
So, I mean, we can see that. I mean, he's not just... He's doing exactly what he'd normally do to guests who are pro-Palestinian. He's butting in. He's not allowing them to finish their sentences. He's being condescending. And he started to do that a lot, right? But this clip is the one from 3 months ago, and he's often had Mehdi Hassan on the show, and again, it's you're going to see a monologue from him where he's very critical of Israel, but there's a few nuggets in there which I think are very revealing.
Israel's ongoing offensive in Gaza. President Trump now says it's time for Netanyahu to wrap it up. Israel is allowing some aid to trickle into Gaza after an 11-week blockade, but aid workers say it's a drop in the ocean, and the US president has acknowledged that a lot of people in Gaza are starving. Shamefully, Hamas still holds 58 hostages and is watching the total destruction of Gaza and its people because it doesn't want peace and it doesn't value human life. It was increasingly difficult to argue that the exact same statement doesn't apply to Netanyahu's Israeli government. Israel's war on Hamas was not a genocide, but genocide isn't something that happens with the push of a button. A justified war can end with atrocities that stain humanity, as many have through history. So who is going to stop this one before it does, if it hasn't already? Well, joining me now is Mehdi Hassan, the editor-in-chief and CEO of Zatea, and retired Major John Spencer, chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute. OK, let's get into this. Mehdi, welcome back to Uncensored. Listen, you and I have talked about this war in Gaza ever since it started, this phase of the 75-year conflict. And I have resisted going as far as you have done in your criticism of the Israeli government. I resist no more.
Yeah, so that's the important part, right? Now, what do you make of what he said there?
He's coming from a different place, from Tucker Carlson, completely different place. He is coming from the position of liberal Zionism, which basically says a plague on all your houses. There are extremists in Israel, and there are extremists on the Palestinian side. He repeated again that Hamas doesn't care a jot for human life. I don't agree with that assessment at all. I think of Hamas as a product of a resistance movement, and whether you have Hamas there or not, there is still always going to be a strong element of the Palestinian body politic that will resist through armed force, principally and simply because they can't get any movement politically.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with
you.
So
he's in a very, very different place. Yep. Now, he's moved
a whole deal
across a wide terrain as a result of Israel's campaign. I think there's an element of Piers Morgan that is clickbait, a very strong element of that, you know, considering yep. where he was. And I think he's realized that he can get a much bigger audience if he shifts position. He's again a very, very skillful broadcaster and journalist. So he's applying his very skillful techniques. He's the typical example of a circular firing squad.
Yeah.
The fact that he's moved, I think, is interesting because I think there's a lot of disquiet amongst traditional supporters of Israel about what supporting Israel actually means. Does it mean, if you say you're a friend of Israel, which he would say he is or was, that you're a friend of apartheid? Does it mean now that you're a friend of genocide? Does it mean that you are a friend of robots being sent in and demolishing? Because that's what Israel is doing. Does it mean you're a friend of Ben-Gvir? Because he's possibly the next prime minister. I.e., being a supporter of Israel, which, you know, To get anywhere in politics now, you have to support Israel. It's most of the Conservative Party, what's left of it. It's all of reform. And it's the entire leadership of the Labour Party, right? Everyone has to say, in order to get moving up the greasy pole of British politics or American politics, that they're friends of Israel. What actually does that mean? To what extent can you support the idea of, you could say, all right, you know, the liberals and honest would say, we're supporting an Israel for all its citizens. But an Israel for all its citizens has disappeared. It has literally been extinguished. And it's a myth that Israel is a nice, friendly state, that is a democracy, and that cares for its people. And if only it had the right leadership, and if only there were pragmatists on the other side, you'd have two states, however small the Palestinian state was. It's a myth. And that is why, and that is what now the war is challenging. The war is challenging the relationship of all supporters of Israel to Israel itself. And the answers that are coming up in their head are extremely painful, including the answers that are coming up in Piers Morgan's head.
Okay, final question. We both have an editorial meeting that we need to be getting to, so we'll try to wrap it up. Given everything we've discussed, but also what you've seen in the last 23 months and what you've covered on the issue in the last 50 years almost, what do you think is the most viable path to Palestinian liberation? I know it's a big question to end on, isn't it?
I think there has to come a point where Israel feels the cost of what it's doing. And when Israel feels the cost of what it's doing, feels it cannot get away with it, in fact, that what it wants to do, i.e. recreate a biblical Israel, is actually working against in its interests, and an awful lot of their most talented people start leaving, which has already happened, then the politics will change. But there'll be an awful lot of mayhem and death before that. And only then will you get real negotiations with real Palestinian leaders, not puppet leaders, and Jews to say, right, how do we end this? But it's a very, very different discussion to basically naked, militaristic supremacist and particularly racist supremacism that is taking place and taking shape before. Israel needs to turn this conflict, which is a conflict about land, into a religious war like a hole in the head. Because then it will find it has many, many more enemies and there are many, many more Muslims than there are Jews. But that's what it's doing. It's doing it in Al-Aqsa and it's doing it, and it has a religious purpose now. There's always this get out clause from liberal Zionists to say, oh no, we're the nice guys. We're the ones who want to negotiate with Palestinians. It's them, it's the settlers. Now you cannot make that distinction anymore. The settlers are running the show. One way or another, they're running the show. So you can't say there is this pushback. You can't say, before you could say there was a pushback that Netanyahu couldn't prolong a war without the permission of the IDF and Shebet. Now, they represent his interests. There is pushback, and there's a huge amount of dissension in Israel, but not over Palestinian lives, over their own autocracy, because in the end, they will feel what it's like to be a Palestinian at the when Ben-Gavir is actually in charge, because he will turn against anyone who disagrees with him, Jew or non-Jew. They're going to feel it next, and that is why they are pushing back. They're fighting for the control of the Israeli state themselves between the various tribes of Israel. But absolutely none of them feel a tinker's cuss for the fate of Palestinians. They're talking about the future of Jews, and they're talking about the future of Israel. So I think when this whole cycle comes to an end, and war is brought to an end, it may take a generation to do that. The Vietnam War took a very, very long time to actually stop with an American withdrawal. And when America does pull the plug on Israel and say, actually, we're not going to arm you anymore, as indeed Britain did in a diplomatic sense, but also a very big psychological sense to the loyalist unionist community in Northern Ireland. And that happened under Margaret Thatcher. When that plug is pulled and suddenly they think, hang on a moment, are we on our own? Then Israel will behave very, very differently towards its neighbours. Because it's not just the Palestinians it's behaving like supremacists to. It's the Lebanese, it's the Jordanians, it's the Egyptians, it's any Arab. And that is possibly, you know, a lesson for slow learners, but I think the Emiratis are now learning that themselves.
David, thank you so much for your time.